Welcome to the Sustainability Agenda podcast. My name is Fraggle Byrne. Every week I speak to leading figures from the world of sustainability and explore the sustainability agenda in marketing and strategy, technology, innovation, investment and finance. We look at the latest thinking, what's working, and the future and evolution of the sustainability agenda.
The Anthropocene, which you may or may not be familiar with, but it's this idea among geologists that human impacts have become so pervasive and profound and permanent that we have, in effect, created a new age in geology, so that future rocks will kind of bear the record of our passing. And that's because of course, climate change, but also the extinction of species, things like blowing up nuclear bombs.
I'm very pleased today to introduce David Bielow. David is the science curator at TED Talks, as well as a contributing editor for Scientific American. He recently published The Unnatural World, The Race to Remake Civilization, Earth's Newest Age, in which he explores the emergence of the Anthropocene, the period during which human activity has been the dominant influence on climate and the environment, and he searches for ideas on how humans might live on a fast-changing planet. Thank you very much, David, for taking the time to speak to the Sustainability Agenda podcast today. I'm very much looking forward to talk to you about your book, The Unnatural World.
Thanks for having me.
So you've recently written The Unnatural World. What is your work? What do you do?
Well, my day job is I'm the science curator at TED Talks. For those who don't know, they're 12 to 18 minute talks spreading theoretically good ideas, like not unlike sustainability. And what does it mean to be the science curator? It means that I pick the various science topics and science ideas and science speakers, and then kind of help them get ready for the stage. And then I also help out with, a general view on science for all the other things that TED does, like our ideas blog, the TED Fellows program, where we host innovative thinkers and help them kind of get their projects off the ground, and the TED Prize, where we give $1 million to somebody with a great idea. But then, I guess by night, I remain a journalist and writer. I worked for many years at Scientific American, a science magazine, and I still write for them and a variety of other publications. And over the course of many years, I was able to cobble together the writing for this book, The Unnatural World.
Right. Well, you say cobbled together. I think that's an understatement. There's a tremendous amount of research, I think, that's gone into that book and a lot of thinking. So can you talk about, what is the book about? How did you come to write it, David?
So about 10 years ago, if you can believe that, I had been, covering climate change and other kind of environmental issues for about 10 years at that point. And I was thinking, this will sound ironic, that we had kind of hit a wall, just kind of talking about climate change or talking about sustainability, talking about all these environmental problems in their separate silos wasn't solving the problem, but was in some cases actually exacerbating the problem. I guess one of the biggest examples of that for me is the drive for corn ethanol here in the United States. So we replaced some of our gasoline supply with ethanol brewed from our corn crops. I'm originally from the Midwest, and so I could see what kind of planting out the entire middle part of the United States in corn did to the environment. And that was meant to help with climate change, but of course ended up exacerbating things like the dead zone at the mouth of the Mississippi, water pollution and the like. So I was hoping to find some way to explore these topics together, because I really do feel that if we're going to solve challenges like climate change and energy poverty, we have to solve those challenges together, not separately. If we solve them separately, we'll end up with things like corn ethanol, and we'll end up exacerbating problems. So I happened upon this term, and it's a terrible term, the Anthropocene, which you may or may not be familiar with, but it's this idea among geologists that human impacts have become so pervasive and profound and permanent that we have, in effect, created a new age in geology, so that future rocks will kind of bear the record of our passing. And that's because of course, climate change, but also the extinction of species, things like blowing up nuclear bombs. So a lot of things fall under this this rubric. And so I thought that might be a really interesting way to explore this idea of solving these environmental challenges together, because the Anthropocene, of course, brings them all together in one concept, if you will. It took me about, 5 or 6 years to convince anyone else that that was a really good idea for a book. And then it took, 3 or 4 years of travel and research to actually deliver said book, because, of course, when you're talking about something that's global in nature, like the Anthropocene, you can kind of go anywhere and write about anything and it will fit the narrative. So the problem becomes more what not to include than what to include.
Fascinating. Now, you talked about the Anthropocene, and as you say, it's a strange word, increasingly in common usage, I guess, particularly around climate change and other related issues, extinction particularly. I have heard some people say it should rightly be called the Capitalocene. That's
yeah.
Associated with industrialization and capitalism. I don't know what you think of that.
Well, I think everybody has a proposal for a better name for the Anthropocene, and there's no doubt that kind of one of the leading markers of the Anthropocene is capitalism. Is this rush to kind of extract as much value from nature as possible, and sell that value on the open market, and not worry too much about what happens to the forest, or the animals of the forest, or the water, or anything else. So, Capitalocene is one proposal. Pyrocene is another one. Kinesocene. I mean, just straight up obscene. Some people like. A lot of people have a lot of different proposals. But for better or worse, we seem to be stuck with the Anthropocene one way or the other. I stick with that as much as I dislike it.
Yes, that's a slightly ugly word, yes. Now, did you start out with a thesis an idea behind this? I mean, what was the question you were... You identified, as you said, this period, this geological period, this nascent or this latent, this period which is upon us now. What was the underlying, I guess, thesis or idea that you set out to explore?
Yeah, so basically, first I wanted to kind of explore this idea of the Anthropocene. What is it? Are we in it? And I essentially, not to spoil the book, because please go out and read it, I opt for yes we are, and I lay out the case for that. And then really more of the book is spent talking about, if we're in it, what should we do to make it better rather than worse? Because for a lot of people, the idea of the Anthropocene is very scary, doom-laden, feels like the end of the world, climate change is getting worse, extinction may be getting worse, ocean acidification getting worse. All these environmental challenges seem to be trending in the wrong direction. But as you know from reading the book, what I did was kind of travel around the world and find the people, the perhaps unusually optimistic people, who are trying to make for a better Anthropocene by solving some of these challenges or trying to show how they could be solved if some of these solutions were kind of adopted at scale. And that ranges from scientists to government bureaucrats to, little girls in far western China.
Yes, amazing range of not just locales, geographies, ideas, people.
Yeah, it's tough to keep it narrow when it's when it's the Anthropocene, when it's global.
Yes. And so, you identified, and we can maybe talk about some of the ideas that you find particularly exciting, that are out there, and this spirit of innovation and so forth. Did that, are you optimistic? Did you feel, I mean, do you feel like business as usual, that there's an innate innovation quality to the world today, power of technology, people can do things for so much smaller money, people are much more aware, there's a lot more progressive voices, things like that. Or do you think something else needs to change?
Well, it's a bit of both. So I am heartened by kind of the optimism and innovation I see out there in people. We are the problem, for better or worse, and we are also the solution. And the good news is there are solutions out there. The problem, what I guess makes me more pessimistic, is that these solutions are not being done kind of together in a coordinated fashion. So you might be trying to combat climate change while say ignoring energy poverty. And like I said, you will not solve either of those problems in isolation. They're also not happening at the speed that is required. So if we're going to transition away from fossil fuels, we need to do that as quickly as possible. And as we all know from reading the newspaper or checking tweets online, that is not necessarily what's happening, particularly here in the United States. Although there are some reasons for optimism here. And then finally, it's not only is it not happening at the speed that's required, it's not happening at the scale that's required. So if you think just about energy, we still get roughly 80% of all the energy that we use all around the world, driving cars, electricity, you name it, from fossil fuels. That is despite, a couple decades of renewables growing faster and faster than anything else. So we really need to scale those solutions up quicker. And so the pessimism, I guess, is that what we lack is not the solutions. What we lack is the will, is the political will and personal will to make the changes that are required. And so ultimately, what I decided is that the Anthropocene is a problem of not nature, but human nature.
Yes, and we're living right through that now, aren't we? Some of the
Yes, we
consequences
are.
of change of will and the role of governments, particularly in the US, and maybe I certainly like to come back to that. A key question, I guess, is I do a podcast where I talk to social entrepreneurs, and it's amazing the proliferation of enthusiastic, capable, skilled, motivated social entrepreneurs. People, innovators working around the world in so many domains. A key question that comes up again and again is this question of scaling, and what are the few things that can have the biggest impact? And I wonder whether you have some thoughts on a few ideas of the many, many ideas that you came across that you think have the most potential in that sense.
Well, it's going to sound counterintuitive, but the biggest thing that anybody can do to solve any of these environmental challenges is kind of the twin social goal of educating girls and empowering women. Now, that doesn't sound like it has anything to do with greenhouse gas emissions or ocean acidification or species extinction. But across the board, when you when women are educated and empowered, we see around the world better environmental outcomes. That ranges from everybody's favorite bugaboo, which is human population, to just better management of, say, forestry resources or water resources. And I say this as a guy. Apparently, the ladies are better and kind of conserving those resources than the Anthropos in Anthropocene would kind of muck things up being in charge. So that's actually the number one thing that people can do and can fight for. And that seems like that falls right within the social entrepreneur space, but it seems very divorced from environmental problems. But I'm here to tell you that based on my research and travels, that is definitely not the case. And it actually was one of the greatest sources of optimism for me was the fact that that particular social transformation is happening in places all around the world. So in South Africa, in China, you name it, wherever I went, things are changing for girls and women and changing for the better. And that's good news for a better Anthropocene.
Fascinating. I didn't know that, David. I knew there'd been progress, and I know it's an important issue on many funders' minds. And I've spoken to some key, interesting social entrepreneurs working in the education space. But that's very interesting to hear. In one sense, that's the answer to the question in terms of one thing you can do that have a big impact. I guess, on the other hand, potentially that's quite a fragmented problem as well, in the sense that it's tied into local education systems, regional education systems in different countries, and quite a difficult thing, I think, to get at in any kind of scale way.
Yes, it's a so you think about it, the social movements that are happening right now in human history are in fact happening at a speed and scale that is unprecedented, and I think the first such kind of global movement was the war against the moral war against slavery, and that went from being unthinkable and the idea of just a few kind of, frankly, they were thought to be deranged folks, who had a real kind of moral purpose, to being, broadly accepted all around the globe. And, slavery is not something that is acceptable anymore. And that is a massive revolution in human nature. Frankly, or think about tobacco and what has happened there. I remember when I was growing up, the sci-fi comic books of the future, showed flying cars and whatever else. But those flying cars were always driven by kind of brillantined dads who were still smoking cigarettes. Now the flying cars are kind of slowly and surely starting to appear, but the brillantine dads smoking cigarettes, they're not on the scene. So I think we overestimate kind of the pace of technological change, but we underestimate the power of social change, and it is happening, and it's happening fast. We just need it to happen even faster.
Very interesting. Very interesting. Now, talking about technology, America, West Coast particularly, great technological prowess, and there are many voices that look to technology to provide solutions, a silver bullet to just tools that can transform productivity in so many different areas. Well, what do you think, what's your sense after the research that you've done on the potential of technology to help deal with these questions?
Well, we're certainly going to need it, right? Let's just take the example of climate change. We have already burned enough fossil fuels to change the climate. We're seeing that all around us, and we're continuing to burn fossil fuels. So we're kind of building up this burden in the atmosphere, and eventually we're going to have to clean that up. And that's where technology comes in, both the technology to replace the fossil fuel burning in the first place, but also potentially the technology to kind of suck CO2 back out of the sky and do something with it, whether that be turning it back into a fuel of some kind or burying it or whatever might be done. And so those are our technology solutions that we're going to need. And I, as you know from reading the book, spent some time kind of pursuing Elon Musk, who I think, for those who don't know him, in some ways personifies this Silicon Valley ethos of, move fast and break things in an attempt to change the world. So, for example, he has an electric car company in Tesla. He has a solar power company in Solar City, which has now been absorbed by Tesla. And Tesla has also built the world's largest battery factory in partnership with Panasonic. And then as kind of a side project, he has, a space company called SpaceX, which he hopes will one day take him to Mars. So he's not somebody who dreams small, and that's why I picked him as kind of the personification of this technological wizardry approach. But the reality is, even as much as kind of Elon Musk can do in offering a kind of soup-to-nuts solution. So you've got your electric car, which obviously doesn't emit anything, but it has to get its electricity from somewhere, so hopefully it gets it, at least in Elon's view, from solar panels he's put on your rooftop. And then suddenly, we're driving and living without having to burn too many fossil fuels, or as many fossil fuels, and you've kind of solved a little bit of the climate conundrum. But the reality is, for something like that to happen, it takes government policy, as you mentioned. It takes social change. So people need to become more fond of solar roof tiles and solar panels on their roof than they are of, say, chimneys, which are kind of a relic technology on our houses. A nice one, but not too many folks are relying on wood to heat their homes anymore. And it may be that the social change we're really looking for is something that gets rid of the car altogether, or transitions us to many, many fewer cars via autonomous vehicles. So, individuals can kind of help and inspire, and we need that, but we also need kind of the mass movement to get these changes at the speed and scale that is required to really replace 80% of energy. And I should note, right, that part of the reason people want to call it the capitalist scene is because, fossil fuels kind of empowered capitalism to eat the world, if you will, and the burning of those fossil fuels, that's really the best marker of this Anthropocene, if there is one. There are these tiny little balls of soot that are left after you burn fossil fuels, whether it's natural gas, oil, or coal. And those tiny little balls of soot can now be found everywhere on Earth, from the remotest reaches of the Amazon to the remotest reaches of Antarctica. It's there. It'll be trapped in the ice if there's any ice left, but it will certainly be trapped in lake sediments and other things that will be future rocks. And we know these tiny little balls of soot last because we found them from 66 million years ago when some volcanism after an asteroid hit the Earth and wiped out the dinosaurs. Some volcanism set off similar burning and released a bunch of soot like this into the atmosphere. It settled into the lake sediments, and we can find it in the rock today. So there's a good chance that our fossil fuel burning will be around, in rocks 66 million years from now. And the only question is whether it will be, whether there will be any humans around to find that soot in the rock record.
Absolutely. And in parallel, plastics. Clearly,
yes.
Major,
That's another alternative name, the plasticine, because that was a huge step change, and plastic is truly everywhere as well. The trick with the plasticine is it's going to actually be more like fossils, because plastics are they're not so easy to degrade on human timescales, but on geologic timescales, they'll be kind of cooked away by the Earth's heat and pressure. But they may leave marks in the rock. So your vinyl record could be, etched into rock. And if anybody could figure that out 66 million years from now, they might be able to play your I don't know, your favorite band from a plastic fossil. And of course, we have new rocks known as plastic agglomerate. This is when kind of lava flow interacts with all the plastic on the beaches in, say, Hawaii, and forms this strange kind of agglomeration rock that's pretty permanent. Plastics is another big way we're going to leave our mark on the planet. And then one that folks tend not to think about anymore, but is still one of the big existential risks facing us is nuclear weapons, and especially all the nuclear weapons testing that went on in the 40s and 50s and 60s and even into the 70s and 80s. By blowing up all those nuclear bombs, we actually put new elements on the Earth that had never been here before in all the 4.5 billion years of Earth's history. So plutonium never existed on Earth prior to our nuclear weapons. And that stuff will be in the rock record for the foreseeable future.
Yes, shocking. It's the scale is terrifying, really, isn't it? We see ourselves as ephemeral or evanescent or short-lived, and yet the damage that's been done to the planet itself will seemingly continue into the timeless future.
Well, it is hard to imagine, right? You look at the ocean or the sky, and you think this is, vast and untamable, and how could human beings have an impact on it? But the reality is, we are having that impact. You can see it all around you. I suspect that if carbon dioxide wasn't an odorless, colorless gas, we probably would have acted to deal with climate change a lot sooner, because we have made such a significant change to the air, and we seem to react to things like, say, smog, which you can see a lot quicker than we do to things that are invisible, but equally potentially dangerous, like carbon dioxide. We collectively, as humanity, are transforming the planet. And we're not the first life forms to ever do this, but we're the first ones who are conscious, right? And so we could choose differently. We don't have to be an asteroid that kind of hits the planet and resets all of biology, or we don't have to behave like like an ice age, like the glaciers of an ice age, and kind of terraform the entire planet, even if that's what we're doing now, because we can think about it, we can recognize it, and we can change things.
Yes, absolutely. Now, reasons to be optimistic in terms of social change, as we've said, social movements, social innovation, social entrepreneurs, social change. What about government policy? And you started this book, I guess, at what was a rising tide, at least, or a high tide of certainly U.S. Activism in terms of the government supporting the environment in various different ways. That has changed. What was your sense writing the book of the role that this had to play generally?
Well, I have joked that another possible name for the Anthropocene could be the Trumpocene, and if we put his name on it, then perhaps he'll start to pay attention to these issues, because that seems to work
Yes,
in other areas of his life.
yes.
And certainly our current president embodies many of the characteristics that kind of got us into the Anthropocene in the first place. That said, some of these social changes and economic changes are not susceptible to kind of what government is in power in the U.S. or China or the U.K. or wherever you want to look. They're secular trends, if you will. So, for example, here in the United States, sticking with climate change, our CO2 pollution has gone down precipitously because we are transitioning away from coal and into natural gas, which, while still a fossil fuel, is a far less polluting fossil fuel than coal. And, our emissions are getting back to 1990 levels, and that's even without strong government policy to push it in that direction. That's really just economic incentives. And even more heartening are things like the fact that Texas, which is probably the reddest state in the United States, is also the leader in wind power, and it's simply because it makes economic sense. Texas is a windy, vast place, and they invested in the power lines and the wind turbines, and now they get a good chunk of their electricity from the wind. So they are cleaning up significantly, and you see similar things in Trump voting states across across the board. So it's kind of divorced from politics. Now, of course, government incentives are important. The wind industry would not have gotten off the ground without tax incentives and other things, though it doesn't necessarily need them now. Same is true for solar or nuclear or whatever your favored fossil fuel alternative might be. So I'm not trying to say that government policy isn't important. And certainly what we need governments to do is invest in the kind of unstructured research that can deliver huge breakthroughs that we can't even foresee, because some of those will be needed. So, for example, I write about a government program here in the United States called ARPA-E, which stands for the Advanced Research Projects Agency for Energy. It is meant to invest in kind of very strange energy projects that might have a huge impact. So one of my favorites is this kind of strange program called Electrofuels. What does that mean? It means how do we harness biology, these tiny little microorganisms that actually can turn electricity and CO2 into usable fuels for cars. And the like. And if that could be, if there could be breakthroughs there and that could be scaled up, then that could be an alternative to gasoline and something to compete with Elon Musk's vision of an electric car future. So if we could get governments to kind of fund that open-ended research in energy, we might be a lot better off. But of course, that's a little bit more difficult when folks don't necessarily even believe in the underlying problem, as we're not quite sure what Donald Trump thinks about climate change. We're pretty sure we know what he thinks about female empowerment, though.
Yes, yes, and whatever about climate change, also recognition of the fundamental role that this government investment has had in the technological revolutions that we've seen in recent years in the United States, and so many of the technologies from, you know, PARC and other areas all came out of, or many came out of, spun out of, you know, research programs that were funded by the US government, not least of which the ARPANET and the internet and related things. But that is something that's a story not often told.
That's right. And one of the aspects of that story is that, you know, one of the reasons the government funded all this stuff was military needs.
Yes.
That sounds ominous, but this is also true in green energy. The reality is that the U.S., you know, flies jets around on fossil fuels purchased from some of the countries that we are, in fact, bombing, and the military is aware enough to know that that's probably not sustainable, and is looking for alternatives, whether that be, you know, solar power to help kind of U.S. military bases be kind of self-sufficient for electricity, not dependent on you know, whatever the surrounding conditions might be, or you know, tanks and jets that can fly on. It can drive or fly on biofuels that are not reliant on, you know, say, oil imported from the Middle East. So you know, that may not be the best of human nature, but it has delivered some significant breakthroughs in the past, whether you want to talk about the GPS that lets us find each other in cities, or the internet, or things of that nature that just came out of military research in the 40s, 50s, and 60s. Hopefully some of the military research of the 90s, you know, 2000s, and today will, you know, kind of pave the way for this alternative energy future.
Right. That's very interesting. And I guess also bearing in mind that notwithstanding the rhetoric from various parts of the US government, the military has always had a very wary eye on the risks associated with climate change, and they certainly don't underestimate the challenges that we face there.
That's exactly right. You know, you speak to even James Mattis, our new Secretary of Defense under Trump, has acknowledged that, you know, climate change is what they call a threat multiplier, in that it makes bad things worse. And often the military will point to the situation in Syria as an example of how climate change can exacerbate, you know, underlying tensions, what with the drought that kind of helped kick off this horrible humanitarian crisis that has now, in many ways, reshaped the politics of all of Europe. And that's just a small taste of what we might face when climate change gets really bad if we don't do anything about it.
Absolutely, absolutely. Now, I want to talk about geoengineering, something you touch on in the book. What's your view on geoengineering, a very controversial and topic of the moment?
I was going to say, Syria wasn't controversial enough for you. Now you want to kick it up a notch? Yeah, so
no,
geoengineering
no pressure.
Is, for those who don't know, is this idea that, well, we've been kind of unwittingly transforming planetary scale systems. So dumping CO2 in the atmosphere and changing climate, dumping CO2 in the atmosphere and changing the acid levels of the ocean, you know, making nitrogen fertilizer and changing the entire nitrogen cycle. We've done that all unwittingly. So perhaps we should think about doing things wittingly, and geoengineering would be kind of large-scale interventions in various Earth systems, whether that be ocean circulation or the atmosphere or you name it, to affect a change. And most often this gets invoked in the climate change arena because we have done not enough to address that challenge. And so the ideas are, well, there are two types of geoengineering. There are the kinds that, like I mentioned, suck carbon dioxide back out of the sky. Those tend to be relatively safe, but also incredibly slow. And then there are those that attempt to block sunlight so as to avoid the extra heat that CO2 would otherwise trap. And that goes by the terrible name solar radiation management, which sounds like something out of a Bond novel, I guess. And those tend to be fast-acting, but have all kinds of potential unintended consequences that we're not really quite sure of. And the argument that rages right now is, do we need to use these? But also, how can we be prepared to use some of these techniques in a way that is, or how can we know what the ramifications are? Because unfortunately, some of these solar radiation management techniques, such as hazing the stratosphere with various kinds of particles, are relatively cheap. And by relatively cheap, I mean on the scale of kind of military budgets, if you will. So billions of dollars, but then again, there are individual human beings who have billions of dollars, and therefore, you know, if they were to purchase a fleet of jets and get, I don't know, the sulfur from Canada's tar sands, they could embark on an individual geoengineering project. And the only thing to stop them would be, I guess, the various militaries of the world. That's not likely to happen. But what is perhaps more likely to happen is that some individual nation will decide that they don't like what's happening to them under climate change, let's say China, and will undertake some kind of either experiment or geoengineering program, and what would be in place to stop them, short of all-out, conflict. And the problem with those solar radiation management techniques is that they have a real impact on the weather, as you won't be surprised to learn. And so if China was to try to kind of tweak the atmosphere to make climate change a little less bad for them, they might affect, say, the rainfall patterns in India. And India might not like that very much, and might, you know, intervene to stop what China is doing. So these planetary scale interventions could quickly get out of hand, while at the same time we seem to be potentially heading towards a future where we might need a little solar radiation management to buy time, if you will, to address the underlying problem, which is this excess CO2 that we've dumped in the atmosphere. So it's a pretty scary prospect. I it doesn't make a lot of sense to me to do the solar management at this point, because of the unintended consequences and the real fundamental problem that you would never be able to stop. Once you started doing this, you would have to continually, say, haze the sky until the underlying problem was solved. So it doesn't get at the core of the problem. That said, the other geoengineering technologies, the ones that do address CO2 pollution in the atmosphere, those do seem to be required. But the good news on that front is that there's an amazing technology that removes CO2 from the atmosphere each and every day, and they're called plants. And we know they're benign. So there is hope on that front too.
Yes, absolutely. And low-tech solutions, no-tech solutions. What did you get sense the lay of the land, the climate, the appetite for geoengineering generally? Did you find people quite becoming keener, or were there any particular groups that were? And I'm just wondering also in the sense of the financial side of these innovations and so forth, how they get funded and what kind of returns that, if it's private capital in some cases that is going to support this, what kind of returns that they would expect?
Yeah, it's a huge challenge, and this is where governments would be required, particularly on the CO2 removal side. So the irony on the CO2 removal side is that the projects that have occurred outside of plants, which happen all the time on their own, yay plants, the projects that have occurred have all been financed via, at least in the United States, and largely around the world, via some kind of product cycle. So the CO2 either goes into a greenhouse, say, to help plants grow better, the CO2 gets turned into gets used as lime or carbonate, that kind of thing. Or worst of all, the biggest projects actually use the CO2 as a fluid to flush out more oil. That seems to be the easiest way to make an economic return on CO2 removal. But of course, once you flush out more oil, that oil gets burned and you end up with CO2 in the atmosphere again. So we haven't quite figured out the CO2 removal side of things. And on the solar radiation management side of things, it's really more of a, it's hard to see the business case for that. It's really an intervention that might be undertaken by a government. And that's why it quickly goes to these dystopian scenarios of, a rogue billionaire or a rogue nation doing this, because it's hard to see how you would make money from hazing the stratosphere. Maybe via some insurance product or avoided risks, but I would imagine that it would be hard to find counterparties for that particular risk.
Yes, yes, indeed. Now, I want to ask you about the SDGs. They presumably weren't in place when you started writing the book, and they have, you know, we've now had COP21 and just this massive commitment around the world, because you talked about the challenge, I guess, the trade-off in many cases of different goals and the challenge of approaching this in an integrated way. I don't know whether you have any thoughts on that.
Well, so two things on that. One is the United Nations is actually undertaking an effort to deal with geoengineering because it is recognized in the scientific community and in the kind of governance community that that this is a significant challenge that could get out of control if we don't start thinking about it now before anybody does anything drastic. And as you, this in some ways was touched off by the fact that a few years ago, a wannabe geoengineer in Canada actually went out to sea and fertilized the ocean. So essentially, kind of trying to harness the tiny little microscopic plants of the sea to help deal with our CO2 problem, which isn't a terrible idea. The problem was that he kind of did it on his own and without government or scientific oversight, and people were a little bit freaked out to see that you know, one guy and a fishing crew could kind of interfere with the global climate. That's why the UN has decided it's time to start thinking about these things, because there are examples. As far as, you know, the Sustainable Development Goals and the United Nations system more generally, unfortunately, kind of as presently constituted, the United Nations is a perfect example of this kind of siloing of problems that that I talked about. So you might be interested in water quality goals or the ocean goals, and you're not necessarily making the link to, you know, energy poverty or poverty goals, and how the two are interrelated. You know, we're, as I mentioned before, you know, there's still more than a billion people without access to modern energy. That that leads to deforestation, which exacerbates climate change, and you know, has all these other kind of knock-on consequences for human health and everything else. And that problem, if we don't solve that problem correctly, then we will make climate change infinitely worse. And if we try to solve climate change by limiting, I don't know, access to modern energy for various peoples around the world, I don't think that's going to go down too well either. And unfortunately, we're still not thinking about it in those terms. And that's why I'm hopeful, you know, that a book like mine or this idea of the Anthropocene can kind of help people realize that we really do need to think about it in this kind of integrated, holistic way, or we're never truly going to get a handle, you know, on these interrelated challenges that we really do need to solve if we're going to have a better Anthropocene, one in which, you know, human civilization, however you want to define that, you know, still exists in some form or another, you know, a couple centuries from now, a couple millennia from now. And, you know, at least from my perspective, that should be the goal. That's probably the goal of sustainability, and it's certainly the goal of a better Anthropocene.
Absolutely, absolutely. You've been in the coalface, down at the coalface for many years. You've been working with and seeing firsthand what's happening around the world. It's a major project. Are you optimistic, David?
In the end, I think on balance, I am optimistic, because there are so many amazing people around the world doing amazing things. And I'll just give you one example. It may not be the most hopeful example, but it's an important one. I traveled to a tiny little coastal city in China called Rizhao. It's actually a beach community, so it's a place where it's a beach resort town, if you will, if you can imagine that in China. Yes, they have algae blooms, but it's also a place where you can, you know, bring your family and swim in the oceans. And there is a bureaucrat there by the name of Fan Chongwei, and he has been tasked with turning Rizhao, this resort town, carbon neutral, which means that it will emit no more carbon dioxide than it kind of takes in or destroys. And so they're trying all kinds of experiments from kind of the circular economy, where the waste of one industrial process becomes the feedstock of another, to command and control pollution measures to try to get this carbon neutral idea off the ground. And the way that things work in China is that if Fan can get something like this working in Rizhao, then it gets scaled up maybe to other bigger cities like Qingdao, which is just up the coast, or possibly to the provincial level. Rizhao is in Shandong province, because that's how they do things in China. They kind of run these little experiments at the local level, and then if they work, they scale them up. That's how China is about to embark on the world's largest carbon trading regime, which will kind of overnight put a price on a large portion of the world's CO2 pollution. So there is hope, and it's coming from some of the places that seem, perhaps from the news, the most hopeless because of the apocalypse and the many other things. But that's actually the spur that is causing people like Fan to try to remedy these problems, and that's what makes me optimistic.
Right, yes. Well, good reason. It sounds like a very interesting project, and certainly a very important one again and again. Putting a price on carbon seems like a very smart and crucial step towards stopping carbon emissions, certainly valuing carbon emissions correctly. What's next for you, David? You've worked hard on this book. It's you're and that's you've got your day job as well. What was there an area that you thought I've really got to come back and really cover this in depth? Or are you having a break? What's on the horizon?
I am definitely still covering kind of all the things in this book. I'm currently, working on an article actually about, I mentioned iron fertilization earlier. There's actually a potential second go-round of that experiment in Chile. Of all places, and so I'm kind of reporting on that, but also, watching what Elon Musk is up to, keeping tabs on my friend Fan, because as you can imagine, going carbon neutral anywhere is extremely difficult, but it's particularly difficult in China. So I'm definitely continuing to report on the issues in this book. And then, I'm trying to think, how do you top the Anthropocene? What should the next project be? And I'm not sure I'm going to top it, but I will try.
Well, thank you very much, David. I wish you the very best success with your continuing the great work that you're doing, and thank you so much for sharing your insights and your views and perspectives on these really important questions and the work that you've done in your book. Thank you.
Thanks for the in-depth conversation. It was fun.
Thank you for listening to the Sustainability Agenda podcast. I hope you found it interesting. Please sign up at the sustainabilityagenda.com website or on iTunes to make sure you don't miss any future episodes.